Greetings. This is Tyler McFeeters with your News Gazette, dated Friday, February 13th, 2026. We'll begin our today's reading on the front page with Night to Shine, Having a Ball. Annual prom-like event rolls out limos and red carpet for people with special needs. Story by Luke Taylor, out of Champaign. At this year's Night to Shine, Jennifer Wells will shine indeed. She has the glittery dress and shoes to be sure of it. This evening will be her eighth attendance at the annual prom event for people with special needs, sponsored by the Tim Tebow Foundation. Night to Shine events happen internationally each year, but each one is unique to the location. In Champaign, First Christian Church plays host. "I like to dance," Wells said, "and ride the limousine. But her favorite part? I like to sing." She'll be requesting tunes from country artist Luke Bryan. Her dress has a certain country flair to it, too. Sparkles are still the main priority, though. Swells doesn't go for big prom dresses that can be inconvenient, but she'll still go the whole nine yards with makeup and nails. "I want to look beautiful," she said. One thing's for certain, she'll be crowned prom queen. Each attendee is crowned by the end of the night. "I always end up crying because everybody's just so happy and everybody's having fun," said Amy Clark, Wells' sister. The last few years, Wells has attended with her best friend, but Clark was her buddy at previous Night to Shine events. Now Clark attends as a volunteer buddy for any guests who need one. Parents of attendees have a separate event to attend to enjoy an evening off, and because no one wants to go to prom with their parents, So buddies help attendees out as they go from one activity to the next and socialize. From the limousine ride to dinner to karaoke to face paint to a shoe shine, the event might be labeled a prom, but there's far more to it than dancing. With hundreds of attendees and a helper for each, not to mention the separate entertainment for parents, make the entire thing a huge production. "It's a lot of people, time, and effort," Clark said. Marilyn Dalton, Wells' mom, said she loves the event. "It's cute. She loves socializing. They're always complimenting each other. Nobody's trying to outdo each other. They're just in their own little worlds, like, this is me," Dalton said. "They're all so happy out there dancing. They just love everybody." Even during the pandemic, Night to Shine went on as a sort of virtual event, with the annual video shout-out from Tim Tebow himself still sent out to everyone who would have participated. Wells' family decorated up the house to celebrate and still has plenty of photos from that night and the many others she's attended. Wells is an expert at all things Night to Shine now and very prepared for her red carpet appearance and photos. "I think it's really a good experience for them," Dalton said. "The faces, just to see the smiles, they love it." Jennifer Wells typically likes to pair the sparkly dress she'll wear to the Night to Shine prom event with equally dazzling jewelry, crown, and shoes to match. And then there's a picture of her tiara. The next story on the front page is Bob Asmussen, a good coach, named to Parkland Hall of Fame. Klutz took over softball team in 2001, then produced fantastic results. Out of Champaign. When then Centennial High School assistant Chuck Klutz took over as Parkland College softball coach in 2001, he wasn't expecting a Hall of Fame career. And the results the first season were modest, a 27-32 record for the Cobras. But the program turned the corner in year two, going 47-19 and finishing as runner-up in the National Junior College Athletic Association Division II tournament. That was the start of an uber-successful run for the Cobras, with Klutz in charge. During his 19 seasons, the team won 770 games and earned 8 trips to the national tournament. Parkland finished second 3 times and also 3rd and 4th. Klutz ended his career ranked among the top 25 coaches nationally in career wins. Oh yeah, that Hall of Fame spot mentioned in the first paragraph is now reality. Parkland College Athletic Director Brendan McHale gave him the good news. "I was surprised," Klutz said. Klutz is part of the 2026 Parkland class that will be honored Saturday during halftime of the Parkland men's basketball game against Rend Lake College. Klutz will be joined by Christy Busher-Perino, volleyball, Haley Ginger, softball, DJ Hoskins, men's basketball, Ashley Lillard, women's basketball, Brady Shanuel, baseball, and Riley Warfel Smith, volleyball. Ginger was an All-American for Klutz. He also worked with Lillard when he was on the women's basketball staff. Unusual path. How did Klutz get into coaching? He wanted to help with his sons and daughters' teams when they attended Centennial High School. Klutz worked on the staff for softball coach Terry Workman, who Klutz considers his mentor. I remember one question he asked me, "What's more important, having fun or winning ball games?" Klutz said. I just looked at Terry and said, "You don't have fun unless you win ball games." That really had a lot to do with me getting into it. Klutz served on the Centennial staff for 6 years. His daughter told Klutz that Parkland was looking for a softball coach. Klutz talked to then Cobras athletic director Rod Lovett and was hired. How did Klutz go from high school coach to junior college Hall of Famer? Klutz points to the student athletes. People say, "Man, you're a great coach." I say, "I'm not a great coach. I'm a good coach. I have great players," Klutz said. "I've always believed the girls win the game. Coaches can prepare them for it, but they have to execute. One game the coach can win is the recruiting battle." Klutz was a hit in that arena. Klutz's teams were filled with talented athletes, most from within 2 hours of Champaign-Urbana. 11 of Klutz Cobras have earned spots in the Parkland Hall of Fame as individuals, and 3 of his teams have made it. With the very unsporty name Klutz, the coach was always willing to make fun of himself. There was back and forth with the players, in a nice way. Background check. Klutz grew up in Dixon, where he played baseball. He stayed in the community and continued in baseball at Sauk Valley Community College. Klutz later played on standout fast-pitch softball teams that won state titles. After his schooling ended, Klutz started his career as a manager for pharmacy chain Walgreens. He was transferred to a Walgreens in Urbana in 1976 and remained in the community. He later went to work for the Heinz Company as an account rep. The 78-year-old still lives in Champaign near Parkland College. He follows his favorite Major League Baseball team, the Chicago Cubs, taking in a game every year. "I go way back to Dale Long and Ernie Banks," Klutz said. In recent years, Klutz helped as a volunteer assistant at Monticello High School. He still gives hitting lessons, which is his forte, along with defense. Looking back on his college or his Hall of Fame career, his one wish that he had started coaching in college earlier. Klutz was in his 50s, his first year at Parkland. Family matters. Klutz has 2 grown children, Michelle Jett and Ryan Klutz. Michelle lives in Champaign and has a daughter, Evan, 27. Ryan, who lives in Fisher, has 2 twin daughters, Olivia and Audrey, 13, daughter Leah, 10, and son Nolan, 6. If any of the grandkids need coaching, Chuck said he will leave it in the capable hands of Ryan. "Actually, my son's better than I am," Klutz said. "He's really good." Bob Asmussen is a college football reporter and columnist for the News Gazette. He can reach at 217-393-8248 or asmussen@newsgazette.com. And turning now to national and world news. Immigration policy. Crackdown to wind down. Trump's border czar praises 2-month Minnesota operation, says ICE enforcement in state will continue. Story by Steve Karnowski of the Associated Press, out of Minneapolis. The Trump administration is ending the immigration crackdown in Minnesota, border czar Tom Homan said Thursday of the 2-month operation that led to thousands of arrests, angry mass protests, and the fatal shootings of 2 U.S. citizens. The operation, which the Department of Homeland Security called its largest immigration enforcement operation ever, has been a flashpoint in the debate over President Donald Trump's mass deportation efforts, flaring up after Renee Good and Alex Preddy were killed by federal officers in Minneapolis. The U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement operation focused on the Minneapolis-St. Paul area resulted in more than 4,000 arrests, Homan said, touting it as a success. "The surge is leaving Minnesota safer," he said. "I'll say it again, it's less of a sanctuary state for criminals." The announcement marks a significant retreat from an operation that has become a major distraction for the Trump administration and more volatile than prior crackdowns in Chicago and Los Angeles. It comes as a new AP-NORC poll found that most U.S. adults say Trump's immigration policies have gone too far. Trump initially said the surge was an effort to root out fraud in publicly funded programs, for which he blamed the state's large Somali community, most of whom are U.S. citizens. But the drive soon shifted gears toward other ethnic groups, such as Latinos. While the administration has portrayed those caught up in the Minnesota sweeps as dangerous criminal illegal aliens, many of them are people with no criminal records, children, including 5-year-old Liam Conejo Ramos, and U.S. citizens. State and local officials, who have frequently clashed with federal authorities since Operation Metro Surge started in December, insist the swarm of immigration officials has inflicted long-term damage on the state's economy and its immigrant community. Minnesota's governor urges continued vigilance. Democratic Governor Tim Walz urged residents Thursday to remain vigilant in the coming days as immigration officers prepare to leave, saying he's not going to express gratitude for the Trump administration officials who caused this unnecessary, unwarranted, and in many cases unconstitutional assault on our state. "It's going to be a long road," Walz said in a news conference where he proposed a $10 million aid package for businesses that have lost revenue because of the immigration enforcement operation. "Minnesotans are decent, caring, loving neighbors, and they're also some of the toughest people you'll find. And we're in this as long as it takes." The governor called on Washington to help fund the recovery. "The federal government needs to pay for what they broke here. You don't get to break things and then just leave without doing something about it," he said. Homan was vague about a timeline for the drawdown, but Walz said Homan had assured him Thursday morning that federal officers would start leaving immediately. "So as soon as they can pack their stuff, book a plane, move on, I would volunteer. We will help you get to the airport. We will clear the road to get to the airport. I will pack your damn bags if that's what it takes," the governor said. Homeland Security funding dispute continues. Homan's announcement came as Democratic lawmakers demand restraints on immigration officers before agreeing to fund DHS. The Trump administration is trying to secure votes in Congress to prevent federal funding from expiring at the end of the week. Walz, a former congressman, said Homan's announcement doesn't make him any readier to support restoring DHS funding. The governor said he has been in contact with Senate Democratic leader Chuck Schumer and House Democratic leader Hakeem Jeffries, urging them to hold the line until you get at least minimum reforms necessary in this rogue agency. In Washington, Senator Richard Blumenthal, a Connecticut Democrat who sits on the Homeland Security Committee, told reporters he'll continue to insist on fundamental and far-reaching reforms at ICE as a condition for funding for DHS. "If Republicans are unwilling to accept reforms and DHS shuts down as a result, they have to explain to the American people why they are imposing this burden simply as a result of demands by the American people for reforms in the way this out-of-control agency needs to be reined in," Blumenthal said. Homan, "Surge will end, but enforcement won't." Homan said immigration enforcement won't end in the state when the Minnesota operation is over, and that the local ICE office will stay in the fight. "President Trump made a promise of mass deportation, and that's what this country is going to get," Homan said. Todd Lyons, the acting director of ICE, said during a hearing in Washington on Thursday that ICE officers are still looking for about 16,840 people in Minnesota with final orders of removal. Homan took over the Minnesota operation in late January after the second fatal shooting by federal immigration agents and amid growing political backlash about how the operation was being run. He said Thursday that he intends to stay in Minnesota to oversee the drawdown that will continue into next week. Minnesota leaders praise the resistance. "During the height of the surge, heavily armed officers were met by resistance from residents upset with their aggressive tactics. U.S. Senator Amy Klobuchar said Minnesotans offered a model of resistance, and she renewed calls to rein in Trump's mass deportation campaign. "Minnesotans stood together, stared down ICE, and never blinked," the Minnesota Democrat said. Our state has shown the world how to protect our democracy and take care of our neighbors. ICE withdrawing from Minnesota is just the beginning. We need accountability for the lives lost and the extraordinary abuses of power at the hands of ICE agents, and we must see a complete overhaul of the agency. Some activists expressed relief at Homan's announcement, but warned that the fight isn't over. Lisa Erbes, a leader of the progressive protest group Indivisible Twin Cities, said officials must be held accountable for the chaos of the crackdown. People have died, families have been torn apart, Erbes said. We can't just say this is over and forget the pain and suffering that has been put on the people of Minnesota. In that same story, Senator Paul confronts DHS chiefs with Preddy's death. Out of Washington in the AP. The men tasked with carrying out President Donald Trump's mass deportation agenda were made to watch a video of the shooting death of Alex Preddy in a slow, moment-by-moment analysis on Thursday by Senator Rand Paul, who repeatedly cast doubt on the tactics used by federal officers and warned that the American people had lost trust in the country's immigration agencies. It was a tense confrontation at a Senate hearing that was called to scrutinize the immigration chiefs as they carry out one of Trump's signature policies and after the deaths of two protesters in Minneapolis over recent weeks at the hands of federal officers. Paul, who paused the video every few seconds to explain his interpretation of the events, argued that Preddy posed no threat to the officers and questioned why the situation culminated in the ICU nurse's death. He is retreating at every moment, said Paul, speaking of Preddy's behavior while officers pepper sprayed him. He's trying to get away, and he's being sprayed in the face. The hearing's witnesses included Todd Lyons, the acting director of Immigration and Customs Enforcement, Rodney Scott, who heads Customs and Border Protection, and Joseph Edlow, who runs U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services. The same officials appeared in front of a House committee earlier this week. Paul's comments were a strong rebuke of the conduct by CBP officers who ultimately shot and killed Preddy on January 24th in Minneapolis. It's clearly evident that the public trust has been lost. To restore trust in ICE and Border Patrol, they must admit their mistakes, be honest and forthright with their rules of engagement, and pledge to reform, Paul said in his opening statements. On the next page of national and world news, Defense Department. Judge, Pentagon violated rights of senator retirees. Out of Washington in the AP. A federal judge agreed Thursday to block the Pentagon from punishing Democratic Senator Mark Kelly, a former Navy pilot, for participating in a video that called on troops to resist unlawful orders. U.S. District Judge Richard Leon ruled that Pentagon officials not only violated Kelly's First Amendment free speech rights, but they also threatened the constitutional liberties of millions of military retirees. The judge invoked an old-fashioned rebuke, horse feathers, in response to the government's claim that Kelly is trying to exempt himself from the rules of military justice. To say the least, our retired veterans deserve more respect from their government, and our Constitution demands they receive it, wrote Leon, who was nominated to the bench by Republican President George W. Bush. Kelly, who represents Arizona, sued in federal court to block his January 5th censure from Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth. Leon's order prohibits the Pentagon from implementing or enforcing Kelly's punishment while his lawsuit is pending. The judge instructed the parties to provide him with an update in 30 days. In November, Kelly and five other Democratic lawmakers appeared in a video in which they urged troops to uphold the Constitution and not to follow unlawful military directives from the Trump administration. Republican President Donald Trump accused the lawmakers of sedition punishable by death in a social media post days later. The court case is just one front in a broader dispute that has spiraled between the group of Democratic lawmakers and the Trump administration since they posted the video. Earlier this week, a Washington grand jury declined to indict the lawmakers over the video. Michigan Senator Alyssa Slotkin has said she has been told the Justice Department could seek a new indictment as soon as Friday. Kelly and Slotkin said at a news conference Wednesday that they are keeping all legal options on the table regarding potentially suing the administration. Next in national and world news, U.S. elections. House passes revamped citizenship voter ID bill, but approval in Senate appears quite unlikely. Story by Nina Heller of CQ Roll Call TNS. After weeks of pressure from rank-and-file Republicans, the House on Wednesday passed a bill aimed at creating a federal voter ID mandate. Dubbed the Save America Act, it would require Americans to prove their citizenship when registering to vote and present photo identification when casting a ballot. It would also require states to submit their voter rolls to the Department of Homeland Security for vetting of citizenship status. The proposal is a more expansive version of a previous iteration known as the SAVE Act, which the House passed in April. Texas Republican Representative Chip Roy, the lead sponsor of the bill, described it as an effort to safeguard the country's elections and dismissed the idea that it would make it harder for Americans to vote. In this age of progressive suicidal empathy, basic concepts such as voter ID and proof of citizenship have been attacked as suppression, he said Wednesday on the floor. Republicans were united in backing the measure, with a final tally of 218 to 213. Just one Democrat, Representative Henry Queller of Texas, crossed party lines to vote in favor. Introduced last month, the bill was fast-tracked to the floor without being marked up in the House Administration Committee, which has jurisdiction over federal election matters. Leaders tapped an unrelated measure to serve as the legislative vehicle. Senate Minority Leader Charles E. Schumer said the legislation would be dead on arrival in the Senate. The SAVE Act would introduce the 21st century equivalent of a democracy that tolerates literacy tests and asks people to guess the number of jelly beans in a jar. And for what reason? Because Donald Trump in this day lies about the 2020 election, he said on the Senate floor, dismissing the president's efforts to paint American elections as rife with fraud. House Republicans took up the bill after pressure from Roy and Florida Republican Representative Ana Paulina Luna, who has been publicly lobbying the Senate to use a so-called talking filibuster to sidestep the 60-vote threshold. Senate Majority Leader John Thune, Republican of South Dakota, appeared to rule out that idea, saying the strategy could eat up precious floor time. You ought to be able to prove that you're a citizen of this country in order to be able to vote. How we get to that vote remains to be seen, Thune told reporters this week. House Majority Leader Steve Scalise, Republican of Louisiana, said he expected to see a lot of public pressure on the Senate to move that bill to the president. Billionaire Elon Musk has used his social media platform to post repeatedly in favor of the bill, and conservative influencer Scott Pressler has made the rounds on the Hill this week to back it. Non-citizens are already barred from voting in federal elections, and documented cases of voter fraud are rare. The measure's photo ID Republican would take effect immediately following the bill's enactment, with the changes applying to all federal elections. The measure would require states to submit voter registration lists to the Homeland Security Department to be compared to its database of citizens. It would allow non-citizens found to be on the voter list to be investigated for potential deportation. It would also allow private individuals to sue election officials for registering people to vote who have not presented documentary proof of citizenship. Democrats have criticized the bill for its limits on acceptable forms of ID for registration, which they say would make it difficult to vote for people who can't afford a passport or who have changed their last names, as many married women do not change their birth certificates to match. The bill would require those who have changed their names to provide additional documentation to establish citizenship, including the option to sign an affidavit. Virginia Democratic Representative Jennifer McClellan described the measure as a modern-day poll tax, citing the cost of various forms of ID and recalling how members of her family fought tooth and nail for voting rights. My great-grandfather, at the turn of the 19th century, in the name of making sure that citizens voted and election integrity, had to take a literacy test and find three white men to vouch for his character, she said during Wednesday's floor debate. History may not repeat itself, but it sure does rhyme. Next in the national and world news, Health and Human Services. Surveys. RFK eroding trust in health agencies. Doctors blast his promotion of false and unverified info. Out of New York in the AP. Since Robert F. Kennedy Jr. was sworn in to lead the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services 1 year ago, he has defended his upending of federal health policy by saying the changes will restore trust in America's public health agencies. But as the longtime leader of the anti-vaccine movement scales back immunization guidance and dismisses scientists and advisors, he has clashed with top medical groups who say he is not following the science. The confrontation is deepening confusion that surged during the COVID-19 pandemic. Surveys show trust in the agencies Kennedy leads is falling, not rising, as the country's health landscape undergoes dramatic change. Kennedy says he aims to boost transparency to empower Americans to make their own health choices. Doctors counter that the false and unverified information he promotes is causing major, perhaps irreversible, damage, and that if enough people forego vaccination, it will prompt a surge of illness and death. People once trusted health agencies regardless of power, or of party, and the government reported the best of what science knows at this point, said Kathleen Hall Jamieson, director of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. Now you cannot confidently go to federal websites and know that, she said. HHS spokesman Andrew Nixon said that trust had suffered during the Biden administration. Kennedy's mandate is to restore transparency, scientific rigor, and accountability, he said. Now we have Trump administration. EPA repeals Keystone in U.S. climate policy. Agency also taking aim at emissions rules. Out of Washington in the AP. The Trump administration on Thursday revoked a scientific finding that long has been the central basis for U.S. action in regulate greenhouse gas emissions and fight climate change, the most aggressive move by the Republican president to roll back climate regulations. The rule, finalized by the Environmental Protection Agency, rescinds a 2009 government declaration known as the Endangerment Finding that determined that carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases threaten public health and welfare. The Obama-era finding is the legal underpinning of nearly all climate regulations under the Clean Air Act for motor vehicles, power plants, and other pollution sources that are heating the planet. The repeal eliminates all greenhouse gas emission standards for cars and trucks and could unleash a broader undoing of climate regulations on stationary sources such as power plants and oil and gas facilities, experts say. Legal challenges are near certain. President Donald Trump called the move the single largest deregulatory action in American history by far, while EPA Administrator Lee Zeldin called the endangerment finding the holy grail of federal regulatory overreach. Trump called the endangerment finding one of the greatest scams in history, claiming falsely that it had no basis in fact or law. On the contrary, over the generations, fossil fuels have saved millions of lives and lifted billions of people out of poverty all over the world, Trump said at a White House ceremony. Although scientists across the globe agree that carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases are driving catastrophic heat waves and storms, droughts, and sea level rise. The EPA also said it will propose a 2-year delay to a Biden-era rule restricting greenhouse gas emissions by cars and light trucks, and the agency will end incentives for lawmakers who install automatic start-stop ignition systems in their vehicles. The device is intended to reduce emissions, but Zeldin said, everyone hates it. And we'll take a short break now and return with the second half hour of your News Gazette, dated Friday, February 13th, 2026. Please stay tuned.